of the men walking ahead of us switched on a flashlight. We were inside some kind of basement garage. In the distance was a huge door that appeared to lift upward with chain pulleys. It resembled a loading dock of some kind. Two cars were sitting with engines running, lights on, hoods pointing toward the door. "Hurry now, get in," Smith said, as he held open one of the doors. I looked at the others getting into the second car. Thelma, Minnie Jean, and Ernie were in the car with me. A white man sat behind the wheel. He had an absolutely terrified expression on his face and was busy looking all around us, his eyes darting back and forth. "Roll your windows up, lock your doors, keep your faces away from the windows. Put your heads down when we start to move." His voice quivered. He hunched over to secure something on the floor, and that's when I saw the gun strapped to his side in a leather holster. Smith leaned down to talk through the open window to the driver. "Move fast and don't stop, no matter what." Then he looked at us and said, "Listen to your driver's instructions and do exactly what he says. Your lives depend on it." We were surrounded by white men in suits, speaking in frightened tones. Their expressions told me we were in the kind of trouble I hadn't even imagined before. The enormous roaring sound coming from the crowd just beyond the door made me wonder whether or not they had waited too long to get us into these cars. Just for one instant, I tried to imagine what would happen if the mob got hold of us.
"Now," Smith shouted, "let her roll."
The driver shifted gears and gunned the engine as I crouched down in the back seat. Suddenly, I heard the loud sound of what must have been a heavy chain dragging. The door was opening, letting streaks of sunlight in. I scooted farther down in my seat, hiding my face. But I decided I had to keep my eyes open. I wanted to know what was happening to me. At least that way, I'd know what to pray for. I felt the car surge ahead. We were climbing upward, out of the basement toward bright sunlight. I could hear the tires spin onto a gravel driveway just beyond the door. The car gained momentum, lunging forward. As the full light of day crept into the windows, the deafening noise of the mob engulfed us.
"Get the niggers! Hang those niggers! Stop those cars!"
I heard somebody shout. Then I saw wave after wave of white faces, angry white faces everywhere. Their mouths were open, shouting threats. Clusters of white hands with fingers extended seemed for a moment to envelop us, clutching, grabbing at us. Some of the faces were moving along with us, coming closer to the car windows.
"Hold on and keep your heads down," the driver shouted.
I heard the engine grind and felt us go faster. The people running beside us accelerated their pace, hurling rocks and sticks at the car. That's when the car really began moving fast, faster than I'd ever ridden before. Finally, there were fewer hands and faces on the car windows. The noises were subsiding. I took a deep breath.
"You all can sit up now, but keep an eye out."
I could that the others in the car behind us were safe. We were mostly silent on our journey, craning our necks, keeping watch in every direction. "Thank you for the ride home," I said to the driver as I climbed out of the car. He cast a pleasant but impatient glance my way. I wanted to say, "Thanks for risking your life to save mine," but I didn't know how it would sound to the others. It was an awkward moment with a stranger, a decent white man.
"Get in the house now. Go," he said,
pausing for an instant, then gunning his engine and pulling away. I waved goodbye to my friends. Standing at the curb for a moment, I peered after the car as it drove away, wondering if he would get into trouble with the segregationists when they found out he was the one who rescued us from the mob. He was the second white man I would pray for God to protect. I turned to see that some of my neighbors had gathered, A few sitting in our lawn chairs, a few standing around talking. I wondered what they were doing there. Then Grandma India rushed out the front door, her arms open to receive me. Thank God you're safe. Your mama is on her way home. She was shoving me, both her hands at my back, not letting me pause to say hello to the alarmed neighbors who kept asking if I was all right. Now you've had your lesson. You don't have to go back that awful school anymore, our neighbor, Mrs. Floyd, said as Grandma ushered me past her. I settled down on the couch in front of the television with the radio blasting loud from the hallway. I sipped the grapefruit soda Grandma had given me and thought about what the mob might have done to us. I worried that they would come looking for us at our homes. Although we had left shortly after noon, word came that the mob continued its rampage. Even after the Central High School registrar came out to announce on a microphone that we had been removed, not everyone believed her. Instead, they surged forward, threatening to overrun the barricades and the police, demanding to see for themselves that only white students remained. A police official convinced them to send representatives inside the school to check. When three women returned to report we were not there, the mob cheered but continued the siege. Armed with guns, ropes, and clubs, the report said, they surged toward the school, in the doors and through the halls, dancing and shouting, 2, 4, 6, 8, we ain't gonna integrate.
Melba? Where's Melba? Is she all right?
Mother Lois came rushing into the living room, disheveled and frantic.
I got here as soon as I could. Those newsmen said you were trapped by the mob.
I'm fine, Mama. I stood to embrace her.
We've made a mistake. You're definitely not going back to that school.
What's that on your knee?
Grandma India asked. I fell. I decided I didn't need to add to Mother's nervousness. I would wait until she calmed down to explain the details of my day.
I heard they passed the hat and collected $140 to encourage those policemen to abandon their duties, Grandma added.
You must have been scared to death. I'm sorry, Mother said.
We all listened as the newscast continued airing sounds of the angry mob taking over the school. I discovered that one reason we were able to slip into the school that morning was that the mob had been preoccupied chasing and beating three black reporters, James Hicks, Alex Wilson, and Moses Newsom, whom they had accused of purposely distracting the crowd in order to allow us time to get in the side door. Mr. Wilson was hit on the head with a brick, and even as he lay wounded on the ground, they continued to kick and beat him. The mob had then turned to beat up white reporters. Several reached police lines. Even after they were inside police cars, they were showered with rocks. A concerned and flustered Conrad rushed into the house to greet me. His friend Clark had told him I was dead. In order to settle him down, Grandma busied him with helping her fix lunch. I remained glued to the news, mulling over whether or not I should tell them what really happened to me that day. I decided it would only make things worse, and maybe it would make them decide I could never go back to the integration. Later on, we got hold of a copy of the evening newspaper, the Arkansas Democrat. The headlines read, "Growing Violence Forces Withdrawal of Negro Students at Central High. Crowds Yell Touches Off Brutal Beating."
These pictures are enough to curdle your blood, Grandma said, pointing to the one of reporter Alex Wilson being beaten.
There was another showing a white man riding on him piggyback. The paper was filled with pictures of the crowd and the police trying desperately to control it. Only by looking at those pictures did I begin to understand the real danger of that mob. In my diary, I wrote, "There seems to be no space for me at Central High.
I don't want integration to be like the merry-go-round. Please, God, make space for me. The phone started to ring nonstop with calls from angry strangers spewing hatred and threats. There were also calls from our family and friends inquiring about my safety and warning us that the mob was continuing to search out and beat up people in our neighborhood. One phone call came from a news reporter who asked what I felt about the situation. Before mother or grandma caught on to what I was doing, I told him. He complimented me, saying I was articulate and asked if I could write. I said yes, and he asked if I would write an article about my first morning at Central. Right there, I just jotted down a few notes and started dictating the article to him as it came into my head, the way I wrote letters to God every night in my diary. All the while I was talking to the reporter, I kept our instructions in mind. Accentuate the positive, don't complain too much. He said my story would appear in newspapers everywhere, just as I had written it, because it was on the Associated Press wire. Sure enough, the next day, I saw it on the front page. Would you have exchanged places with me and entered Central as I did this morning? I went, and I am glad. Previous to making actual entrance into Central, I had feelings that I'm sure have never been experienced by a child of 15 years. Sensations of courage, fear, and challenge haunted me. With the morning came my definite decision. I must go. The Lord is my strength and my shield. My heart trusted in Him, and I am helped. With this verse in mind and a hopeful prayer in my heart, I entered the halls of Central High. The spacious halls brought again the school feeling. However, the atmosphere was not conducive to study, but one of uneasiness. The sea of faces represented no special personality to me. Although some were kind, many showed contempt, especially some boys gathered in the halls. I was beginning to believe that the long, hard fight was over, that finally this American way of life was going to pay off. As I walked through the halls alone, it seemed as if I were lost on an island of strange people, having no way of communicating with them. I longed to tell them, "I won't hurt you. Honest. Give me a chance. Come on. How about it? I'm an average teenager, just like yourself, with the same aspirations and heartaches." But it was useless. Only a few facial expressions told me I had gotten through. Each time as I was about to give up, exhausted from the jeers and insulting remarks, some kind face would come up and say, "I want you here," or "You're pretty," or "Won't you stay and fight it out?" This, above all, made all the "go home, nigger," and "I'm gonna get you before the day is over" fade into the background. There were a few trying experiences, such as being blocked from passage to class by a few rough, tough-looking sideburners, boys who, I'm sure if separated, would not attack a mouse. Then, there were the three women who jumped the fence and attempted to get me. A favorite activity of the kids was to form a group in a circle and scream, 2, 4, 6, 8, we ain't gonna integrate. I know of no physical injury to any of the 9 students. I was slapped by one girl. I turned and said, "Thank you," and continued on my journey to class. I did not realize the size or the intentions of the crowd outside until I was told for my safety I had to leave Central High. This hurt me deeper than I can ever express. I'm glad I went, oh, so glad I went. For now I know, without out-of-school interference, integration is possible in Little Rock, Arkansas. When I finished the article,
I realized it was not the whole truth, but a version that wouldn't jeopardize the integration. If I had told what really happened, one of the officials might say we couldn't go back. I composed the story in a way that would make my day sound okay. Maybe in a few days, if I remained patient and prayed, it would really be that way. White students would welcome me and smile and treat me like an ordinary human being. All that evening, we continued our vigilance on the couch in front of the television. Mother seemed to relax a bit, and Grandma settled down with her almanac and handiwork. The newsmen reported more roving gangs of hooligans doing their evil deeds throughout the city. From his Sea Island, Georgia retreat, Governor Faubus urged our leaders and school officials to allow a cooling-off period before resuming integration. President Eisenhower had earlier complimented us on our bravery in a radio message, saying all parents must have sympathetic understanding for the ordeal to which we 9 children had been subjected. Now he issued a warning statement. I want to make several things very clear in connection with the disgraceful occurrences today at Central High School in the city of Little Rock. I will use the full power of the United States, including whatever force may be necessary, to prevent any obstruction of the law and to carry out the orders of the federal court. He ended his long statement by demanding that all persons engaged in obstruction of justice cease and desist. At least we've got a president who respects the law, Grandma said, applauding. There will be no school for you tomorrow, Melba, Mother Lois said. But I'm going to school tomorrow, aren't I? Conrad asked. Perhaps. We'll have to see how things go, Mother Lois said. I'll bet that Ma will heed the president's words, Grandma said. Things will be back to normal tomorrow. But this time, Grandma was wrong. After a restless night, we awoke on Tuesday to find the mob had not heeded the warning of the president. As early as 7:30 a.m., more than 200 people had gathered in front of Central High to protest our arrival. The headlines read, Ike clears way to send troops. Command cease and desist in legal move. Arkansas Gazette, Tuesday, September 24, 1957. The article said that President Eisenhower signed a history-making proclamation clearing the way for possible use of federal troops to quash any further school integration violence in Little Rock. But next I read, Faubus challenges Ike on using troops. From Sea Island, Georgia, on September 23rd, Governor Faubus had declared that the president couldn't use federal troops to combat the Little Rock integration violence unless he, as governor, requested him to do so. And he added, I don't plan to make any such request. And even as I read those headlines, the announcer on the radio said the unruly crowd surrounding Central High was larger than it had been the day before. 12. Governor Faubus didn't ask for federal troops, but they're up in his face anyhow, Grandma said as we sat watching the arrival of the 101st Airborne Division early Tuesday evening. We were transfixed as we listened to newsmen describe the power of that very special military unit. 52 plane loads, C-123s and C-130s, have brought 1,200 battle-equipped paratroopers to Little Rock to see that integration is carried out at Central High School without further violence. Plane loads of the men of the 101st Airborne Division, stationed at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, started landing at Little Rock Air Force Base at 3:30 p.m. this afternoon, at half-hour intervals. The troop convoy is entering Little Rock to take up positions at Central High School. I sat perfectly still, My attention riveted on the television screen, where the most wonderful pictures moved before my eyes. Silhouetted against the slate gray sky, Jeep headlights cast halos in the evening light as the mighty 101st Airborne Division rolled across the Broadway Bridge into Little Rock. It was a caravan of army vehicles that seemed to go on forever.
"More of God's handiwork,"
Grandma said, her eyes brimming with tears.
"Who'd have thought Mr. Farbus's mistreatment of our 9 little children would bring the president and the 101st down on his head?"
The arrival of the troops made me feel hopeful that I had protection from the mob, but it also made me feel even more frightened because President Eisenhower hadn't chosen to send just any old military unit. The men of the 101st were famous heroes, combat specialists, the newsmen said. If we needed such brave soldiers, the president and those powerful men in his cabinet must have agreed that integration was as dangerous as a hostile enemy in war. It felt to me as though the 9 of us were expected to wage some kind of war to make integration happen. The thought upset me. I knew Mother was alarmed as well when she suggested I leave the next day for Cincinnati to live with Uncle Clancy and attend school there. I didn't want to go away because I knew it would get printed in the newspapers and the segregationists would think I was afraid. They would think they had won. Why couldn't she have made this offer earlier? It would have been so much easier then. For the first time ever, Grandma placed dinner on trays in front of the television so we could hear President Eisenhower speak to the nation.
"Let's put things into perspective. He is our president, and he happens to be talking about us. The whole world's watching. Why shouldn't we?" she said.
Speaking from the White House, President Eisenhower said he sent troops because mob rule in Little Rock menaces the very safety of the United States and the free world. This was so, he said, because gloating communists abroad were using school integration riots to misrepresent the United States and undermine its prestige and influence around the globe. And then he looked straight into the camera and said, "Mob rule cannot be allowed to override the decision of the courts." Later, Governor Farbus came on television to give what one reporter described as a pleading speech. "We are now an occupied territory. In the name of God, whom we all revere, in the name of liberty we hold so dear, in the name of decency which we all cherish, what's happening in America?"
"I can help you figure this out, Mr. Farbus,"
Mother Lois shouted at the screen.
"The president has called your bluff."
Later that night, as my head was swimming with news reports and questions about whether or not to go back to Central High, I wrote in my diary, "Everything in my life is so new. Could I please do some of the old things that I know how to do again? I don't know how to go to school with soldiers. Please show me. P.S. Please help the soldiers to keep the mobs away from me." Instead of going to sleep in my clothing, as I had for several nights before, I put on my pajamas. With the soldiers in town, I felt safe enough to have a deep sleep, something I hadn't done for a long time. I figured the segregationists wouldn't dare do their late-night raids on our house with the president watching so closely. It was very quiet as I turned out the light. With the 101st in town, we didn't hear as many sirens going off. Later, when I woke up thirsty and went to get water, I found Grandma snoring with a rifle lying across her lap. Maybe she felt safer, too. I don't know how long I'd been asleep when I was jolted awake. I sat straight up in bed. The doorbell was ringing, and I heard voices on the front porch,
Mama was standing over me. She put her hand over my mouth and motioned me to get up. The doorbell kept ringing over and over again. We moved toward the living room. Sleepy-eyed Conrad met us in the hallway with a confused expression, asking, "Is somebody shooting at us again?"
"Who is it?"
Grandma yelled through the door as she peeked through the covered glass inset. "White men. It's white men wearing black hats. What are they doing on our front porch at this time of night?" Grandma said as she picked up the shotgun. Then she shouted through the door again.
"State your business, gentlemen, or I'll be forced to do mine."
"We're from the office of the President of the United States. Please open your door," they called back.
"We have a message from your president."
Grandma opened the door ever so slightly and demanded that they show proof of who they were. They passed their identification through the half-open door. Mother Lois examined the writing closely and nodded a yes. "How can we help you?" Grandma lowered the gun to her side, keeping it hidden as she opened the front door a bit more. Mother Lois stood beside her. I thought it was funny as I looked around and noticed we were all wearing our nightgowns and pajamas to greet the messengers from the President of the United States. "Let your daughter go back to school, and she will be protected," one of the men said, handing Mother Lois an envelope. The next morning, Wednesday, September 25th at 8 a.m., as we turned the corner near the Bates home, I saw them. About 50 uniformed soldiers of the 101st. Some stood tall with their rifles at their sides, while others manned the jeeps parked at the curb. Still, other troops walked about holding walkie-talkies to their ears. As I drew nearer to them, I was fascinated by their well-shined boots. Grandma had always said that well-kept shoes were the mark of a disciplined individual. Their guns were also glistening, as though they had been polished, and the creases were sharp in the pant legs of their uniforms. I had heard all those newsmen say, "Screaming Eagle Division of the 101st. But those were just words. I was seeing human beings, flesh and blood men with eyes that looked back at me. They resembled the men I'd seen in army pictures on TV and on the movie screen. Their faces were white, their expressions blank. There were lots of people of both races standing around, talking to each other in whispers. I recognized some of the ministers from our churches. Several of them nodded or smiled at me. I was a little concerned because many people, even those who knew me well, were staring as though I were different from them. Thelma and Minnie Jean stood together inspecting the soldiers close up while the other students milled about. I wondered what we were waiting for. I was told there was an assembly at Central with the military briefing the students. Reporters hung from trees, perched on fences, stood on cars, and darted about with their usual urgency. Cameras were flashing on all sides. There was an eerie hush over the crowd, not unlike the way I'd seen folks behave outside the home of the deceased just before a funeral. From time to time, as we walked about, we nine students acknowledged each other with nods and smiles. Like the others, I felt compelled to stare at the uniformed men. Walking up close to them, I saw that some weren't much older than I was. I had been told that only white soldiers were allowed at Central, because the presence of non-whites would inflame segregationists. Non-whites were sent to the armory, where they would be used as support teams or to guard our homes in case of a dire emergency. There were tears in Mother's eyes as she whispered goodbye. "Make this day the best you can," she said. "Let's bow our heads for a word of prayer." One of our ministers stepped from among the others
and began to say comforting words. I noticed tears were streaming down the faces of many of the adults. I wondered why they were crying just at that moment when I had more hope of staying alive and keeping safe than I had since the integration began. Protect these youngsters and bring them home. Flood the Holy Spirit into the hearts and minds of those who would attack our children. Yes, Lord, several voices echoed. One of the soldiers stepped forward and beckoned the driver of a station wagon to move it closer to the driveway. Two jeeps moved forward, one in front of the station wagon, one behind. Guns were mounted on the hoods of the jeeps. We were already a half hour late for school when we heard the order, "Move out!" And the leader motioned us to get into the station wagon. As we collected ourselves and walked toward the caravan, many of the adults were crying openly. When I turned to wave to Mother Lois, I saw tears in her eyes. I couldn't go back to comfort her. Suddenly, all the soldiers went into action, moving about with precise steps. I hoped I would be allowed to ride in the jeep, although it occurred to me that it didn't have a top, so it wouldn't be as safe. Sure enough, all nine of us were directed to sit in the station wagon. Sarge, our driver, was friendly and pleasant. He had a southern accent different from ours, different even from the one Arkansas whites had. We rolled away from the curb lined with people waving to us. Mama looked even more distraught. I remembered I hadn't kissed her goodbye. The driver explained that we were not riding in a caravan, but a jeep convoy. I could hear helicopters roaring in the distance. Sarge said they were following us to keep watch. We nine said very little to each other. We were too busy asking Sarge about the soldiers. At times the car was so silent I could hear my stomach growl. It was particularly loud because nervousness had caused me to get rid of my breakfast only moments after I'd eaten it. Our convoy moved through streets lined with people on both sides who stood as though they were waiting for a parade. A few friendly folks from our community waved as we passed by. Some of the white people looked totally horrified, while others raised their fists to us. Others shouted ugly words. As we neared the school, I could hear the roar of a helicopter directly overhead. Our convoy was joined by more jeeps. I could see that armed soldiers and jeeps had already blocked off certain intersections approaching the school. Closer to the school, we saw more soldiers and many more hostile white people with scowls on their faces, lining the sidewalk and shaking their fists. But for the first time, I wasn't afraid of them. We pulled up to the front of the school. Groups of soldiers on guard were lined at intervals several feet apart. A group of 20 or more was running at breakneck speed up and down the street in front of Central High School, their rifles with bayonets pointed straight ahead. Sarge said they were doing crowd control, keeping the mob away from us. Sarge said we should wait in the station wagon because the soldiers would come for us. As I looked around, I saw a group of uniformed men walking toward us, their bayonets pointed straight up. Their leader beckoned to us as one of them held open the car door. As I stepped outside the car, I heard a noise behind me. In the distance, there was that chillingly familiar but now muffled chant. 2, 4, 6, 8. We ain't gonna integrate. I turned to see reporters swarming about across the street from the school. I looked up to see the helicopters hovering overhead, hanging in mid-air with their blades whirring. The military leader motioned us to stand still. About 20 soldiers moved toward us, forming an olive drab square with one end open. I glanced at the faces of my friends. Like me, they appeared to be impressed by the imposing sight of military power. There was so much to see, and everything was happening so quickly. We walked through the open end of the square. Erect, rifles at their sides, their faces stern, the soldiers did not make eye contact as they surrounded us in a protective cocoon. After a long moment, the leader motioned us to move forward. Hundreds of Central High students milled about. I could see their astonishment. Some were peering out of windows high above us. Some were watching from the yard. Others were on the landing. Some were tearful, others angry. I felt proud and sad at the same time. Proud that I lived in a country that would go this far to bring justice to a Little Rock girl like me. But sad that they had to go to such great lengths. Yes, this is the United States, I thought to myself. There is a reason that I salute the flag. If these guys just go with us this first time, everything's going to be okay. We began moving forward. The eerie silence of that moment would forever be etched in my memory. All I could hear was my own heartbeat and the sound of boots clicking on the stone. Everyone seemed to be moving in slow motion as I peered past the raised bayonets of the 101st soldiers. I walked on the concrete path toward the front door of the school, the same path the Arkansas National Guard had blocked us from days before. We approached the stairs, our feet moving in unison to the rhythm of the marching click-clack sound of the screaming eagles. Step by step, we climbed upward, where none of my people had ever before walked as a student. We stepped up to the front door of Central High School and crossed the threshold into that place where angry segregationist mobs had forbidden us to go. 13. The screaming eagles had delivered us safely inside the front door of Central High School. The soldiers, we 9 students, white school officials, all of us were standing absolutely still, as though under a spell. It seemed no one knew what to do next. Without any warning, a uniformed soldier stepped out of nowhere with an enormous old-fashioned camera. He pointed it toward us and snapped a picture. The commander of the troops spoke a few words, and our military protectors fell into formation and marched away. I felt naked without that blanket of safety. An alarm warning surged through my body. Principal Jess Matthews greeted us with a forced smile on his face and directed us to our classrooms. It was then that I saw the other group of soldiers. They were wearing a different uniform from the combat soldiers outside, but they carried the same hardware and had the same placid expressions. As the 9 of us turned to go our separate ways, one by one, a soldier followed each of us. Along the winding hallway, near the door we had entered, I passed several clusters of students who stared at me, whispered obscenities, and pointed. They hurled insults at the soldier as well, but he seemed to pay no attention. My class was more than a block away from the front door, near the 14th Street entry to the school. I saw other 101st soldiers standing at intervals along the hall. I turned back to make sure there really was a soldier following me. He was there, all right. As I approached the classroom, he speeded up, coming closer to me. "Melba, my name is Danny." He looked me directly in the eye. He was slight of build, about 5'10" tall, with dark hair and deep-set brown eyes. "I'll be waiting for you here. We're not allowed to go inside the classrooms. If you need me, holler." My heart skipped a beat as the classroom door closed behind me. I looked back once more and saw Danny's eyes peering through the square glass inset in the door. The teacher beckoned me to take a seat near the door, where I was in full view of the soldier. I was one of about 20 students. "You all just gonna sit still and let this nigger come in here like this? I'm leaving. Who's coming with me?" A tall, dark-haired boy paused for a moment, looking around the room. At first, there was silence, but no one left. I took my seat, hoping to settle down and focus on the classwork. Sunlight flooded into the room through a full bank of windows along the far wall. It was a beautiful morning. I tried hard to concentrate, tuning myself into what the teacher was saying as she continued her discussion of diagramming sentences. What a stroke of luck. Mother had played a game with Conrad and me, teaching us diagramming at an early age. It's convenient to have a mom who is an English teacher. I tried hard to ignore the boy, who had now begun a scathing dialogue with one of his companions. He carried on in a low tone, just above a whisper, which everyone could hear, but the teacher could legitimately ignore. You ugly niggas think just because you got those armor boys following you around, you gonna stay here. I swallowed a sadness lump in the back of my throat. I wondered whether or not I should press the teacher to stop him from treating me that way. I decided against it because I thought she must be well aware of what he was doing. Besides, we had been instructed not to make a big deal of reporting things in front of other students, lest we be labeled tattletales. The boy continued his taunting throughout the period. At the end of class, I spoke to the teacher to get a list of back assignments, and during the conversation, I asked if she could do something to calm people down. I hope you don't think we're gonna browbeat our students to please you all, she said. I pushed down my anger and walked out. Danny followed, walking far enough behind so that some students got between him and me. As I walked through the crowded spaces, I felt almost singed by their hostile words and glares. Occasionally, students moved in close to elbow me in my side or shove me. That's when Danny would step closer to make certain they saw him. When one boy walked up to try to push me down the stairs, Danny stared him down. The boy backed away, but he shouted at Danny, "Are you proud of protecting a nigger?" When I entered Mrs. Pickwick's shorthand class, things improved decidedly. It was like being on a peaceful island. She remained ever in control. There were a few whispered nasty remarks, but no outbursts. Her no-nonsense attitude didn't leave room for unruly behavior. I had been there about 30 minutes when I realized I was feeling kind of normal, enjoying the classwork and learning the shorthand characters. My stomach muscles let go a little, and I drew a long, deep breath. I didn't know Mrs. Pickwick, but I liked her and felt safe in her presence. I knew I would always be grateful to her for the moments of peace her class provided. En route to the next class, I had to use the restroom. I had put it off as long as I could. I had hoped I could put it off until I went home. It was what I dreaded most, because the girls' restrooms were so isolated. Danny leaned against the wall, across from the bathroom door, quite a distance away. I hurried inside. The students appeared astonished at the sight of me. "There ain't no sign marked colored on this door, gal," one of them said as I whizzed past. I couldn't respond or even stop to listen to her. I was desperate to find an empty stall. Once inside, with the door closed, I felt alarmed at their whispering and scrambling about, but I couldn't make out exactly what they were saying. I wanted to get out of there as quickly as possible. I promised myself I would drink much less water so I wouldn't have to take that risk so often. The scratching and giggling frightened me. Just as I started to step outside the stall, one of the chorus said, "Nigger! Ain't no soldier in here. We got you all to ourselves. You just wait." I ran out like a shot, pausing only a second to get a few drops of water to clean my hands. That's when I noticed it. Written all over the mirror with lipstick was, "Nigger, go home." Midway through my next class, the bells began ringing in a way I'd never heard before. "Fire drill!" students shouted as they rushed out of the classrooms, gleefully chattering. I was terrified. Waves and waves of white faces rushed toward me, some sneering, some smiling, some angry. Still, others took the opportunity to shower me with ugly words. Outside, I was happy to see all those wonderful soldiers parading with precision, going through a kind of changing of the guard with helicopters roaring overhead. It was a real military show, and one that made me feel safe. Even though Danny was only a short distance away, I began to feel uneasy, exposed to so many angry white students. Minnie Jean and Thelma were nearby, and I spoke with them. To our surprise, two or three white students actually exchanged pleasantries with us. But just beyond, a group of whites began whispering hurtful words. After a while, we were left alone while everyone became fascinated with watching the 101st. Despite the entrancing military activities, time began to drag. At our former school, fire drills had always been brief, 3 to 5 minutes, but now, 25 minutes later, we remained outside Central. I was getting antsy, feeling even more vulnerable standing out in the open that way. There was still a rather large, unhappy crowd gathered across from the school. Photographers and news reporters scrambled about, taking pictures and vying for scraps of information about how we were being received in class. Finally, a bell rang, signaling our return to class. I hesitated as the throng of students made its way back up the front staircase. When the bottom of the stairway had cleared, Danny motioned me to move ahead. By then, I was anxious to go to the cafeteria. I was looking forward to being with my friends, with people I could talk to and laugh with, but Danny said we had been summoned to the vice principal's office. He walked only a few steps behind me as I moved cautiously through the clogged hallway, avoiding close contact with hecklers wherever I could. We moved up to the second floor and into the office, where I was met by Carlotta, Thelma, and Mrs. Huckabee, the girl's vice principal. She was hard to read. I felt neither wrath nor warmth from her. She seemed a woman determined to carry out her duties and keep things going as smoothly as possible. She insisted on escorting us to the restroom and the cafeteria, and we thanked her. The four of us walked to the lower level and into a wider hallway, a brightly lit area of what appeared to be a basement corridor leading to the biggest cafeteria I had ever seen. Danny trailed behind me, taking up a station across from the entry to the cafeteria. I turned to glance at the sea of white faces that stretched before me. The cafeteria seemed to be half the size of a football field, filled with long tables. There was a roar of noise from the hundreds of chatting, laughing students and the clang of utensils. The line of people waiting to pick up their food appeared to go on forever. Many of the students in that room turned to stare at us. All at once, I caught a glimpse of non-white faces, my people serving food behind the counter. I didn't feel the same twinge of painful embarrassment I sometimes felt when I saw my people in service positions in public places. Instead, I was thrilled to see them smiling back at me. The cafeteria line was treacherous, but I survived with my tray of food intact. Over lunch, Carlotta, Thelma, and I were joined by a couple of friendly white girls. For a brief moment, we laughed and talked about ordinary things as though it were a typical school day. Indeed, a few white students were trying to reach out to us. They explained that many of their friends would stay away because they feared segregationists who warned them against any show of kindness toward us. After lunch, as I headed for gym class, I had two more reasons to hope integration could work. Amid all the hecklers taunting me, two girls had smiled and waved a welcome. Danny and I parted company at the door that led to the girls' dressing room. We agreed to meet after I changed into my gym uniform. He would wait near the head of the narrow corridor that led to gym class. I was frightened as I looked down at the bandage on my knee from the last time I had walked those isolated corridors to gym class. I got out of there as fast as I could. I entered the dressing room and changed my clothing, going about my business briskly, even when someone tried to block my way. The stares and name-calling hurt, but I was growing accustomed to coping with it. With surprising speed, I had changed into my uniform and was on my way out to meet Danny. He pointed me toward the concrete stairs that led down to the first level playing field. Several hundred yards beneath us on what had been an enormous playing field, there was now a huge city. Hundreds of olive drab tents stood in meticulous rows. There were jeeps and larger trucks with tarpaulins. It was an absolute beehive of activity. Several soldiers were posted directly below us in the field where my class would be. The sight of pristine lines of marching soldiers going back and forth in the distance calmed my nerves. I walked down the steps to where the class would be playing volleyball and joined the others as they divided themselves into teams. But before we could start playing, a girl called out to Danny.
"You like protecting nigger bitches."
She smiled sweetly and fluttered her eyelashes at him.
"Wouldn't you rather be following me around instead of her?"
Danny's facial muscles tightened, but he said nothing as she continued to spew insults at both of us. The gym teacher was quite a distance away, blowing her whistle and refereeing the game. Occasionally, she would look back, but I wasn't at all certain she could hear the heckling. I joined the game and tried to be as cooperative as possible. When class ended, I played a game with myself. I would earn a world record for getting dressed at the fastest speed known to mankind. When Danny greeted me, he confirmed I had far exceeded his expectations. As he trailed me through an isolated passage to the open hallway, we were confronted by a chorus of chants from sideburners. Copying their hairstyle from James Dean and Elvis, they fancied themselves to be bad boys.
"Hut, 1, 2, 3, march! March company!"
"March to the beat of the nigger drum," the choir of boys chanted as we walked past. Suddenly, one of them came up to me and slammed my books out of my hand onto the floor. We were surrounded by thugs, many much bigger than Danny. "Don't move," Danny whispered. "Stand absolutely still." His words stopped me from running for my life. At that moment, it was hard to remain still. My knees were shaking as the group closed in on us. All at once, from nowhere, other soldiers appeared and made their presence known by holding on to their nightsticks and moving toward us slowly. I wondered where they had come from so quickly. Then I looked behind me, and there were still more, standing against the walls, erect and silent, as though steeled to go into action at any moment. Reluctantly, the hooligans dispersed, leaving a trail of insults in their wake. The soldiers withdrew as quickly and quietly as they had appeared, out of sight in an instant. There was no harsh greeting or heckling as I entered French class. In fact, some of the students wore pleasant expressions. It took a while to realize they had a different kind of unwelcome mat for me. I was excited about French class. Mother Lois spoke fluent French. She often gave Conrad and me lessons over the dinner table. I was anxious to get started because I could see that Central had tape recorders and special headphones, things I hadn't had in my French classes before. The students spent the entire hour speaking in French about suntanning. I understood the language, and I didn't know what to do as one student spoke in French about not wanting to get too dark for fear of being taken for a, a nigger. I blinked back tears of disappointment. A serious headache was overtaking me by the time I headed for study hall, with Danny tagging behind. Entering the door was like walking into a zoo with animals outside their cages. The room was double the size of the largest classroom in my old school. I'd never seen anything like it or imagined in my wildest dreams that an important school like Central could allow such outrageous behavior. Stomping, walking, shouting, sailing paper airplanes through the air, students were milling about as though they were having a wild party. The teacher sat meekly behind his desk, a spectator stripped of the desire or power to make them behave. I took 5 steps into the room, and everybody fell silent. abandoning their activities to glare at me. "Take that seat over there," the study hall teacher said. But I wanted to ask him for a seat near the door where I could see Danny, but he cut me off. "Did you hear me? I said, take the seat over there or see the principal." The teacher returned to reading his newspaper while the students threw spitballs. They directed only a few at me. Mostly, they were involved in their own little games. At one point, they started passing notes back and forth. When one was passed to me, I opened it. "Nigger, go home," it read. I looked at it without emotion, folded it neatly, and put it aside.
"The helicopters are coming to pick up the nigger,"
someone shouted. Thank God, I thought. I had lived through the wildest hour where nobody did anything major to me, but their threats, near misses, and flying paper airplanes and pencils had shattered my nerves. "Helicopters. Home," I whispered. It seemed like a lifetime since I had been home and comfortable and safe. Just then, Danny opened the door and beckoned to me. "Let's move out for home," he said. The whirring sound of the helicopter overhead drowned out some of the shouted insults as I made my way out of the study hall. Danny and I headed to the principal's office, where I was to connect with the other students and soldiers for the trip home. I had made it through my first day at Central High. Reading, writing, and riding. The comedic dialogue of our group had already begun before we left the building. What I needed most was the kind of laughter that would take my headache away. There we were, the nine of us, smiling, chatting, and behaving as though we were normal teenagers ending a normal school day. At the same time, uniformed and armed soldiers with bayonets held high were gathering around us for the trip out of the building. Nestled within the same protective cocoon that had enveloped us on our way into school, we made our exit through the front door. I looked back to see a group of white students trailing behind us, their hostile feelings painted on their faces. The engine of the helicopter roared louder as we descended the stairs. Protected by the mighty power of the screaming eagles, we walked to the Army staff car waiting at the curb. Once again, a group of soldiers was galloping back and forth. Even the chants of 2, 4, 6, 8, we ain't gonna integrate, could not dispel my joy. I was going home. As I stepped into the car, a wave of peace washed over me. "Relax, we're on the move," Sarge, our driver, said as we snuggled down into our seats. The convoy was the same as it had been that morning. In front, the open jeep filled with soldiers, a machine gun mounted on its hood with a similar vehicle behind us. As we pulled away from Central High, I looked back to see students gathered on the school lawn, staring at us as though they were watching a parade they hadn't known was coming their way. For just one tiny instant, I even felt a twinge of sympathy for them. "You all have a good day, did you?" Sarge said, making polite conversation. We all gave our different versions of the same answer. "Good isn't exactly the word to describe my day." "All right."
"Depends on what you mean by good. My mama never told me there'd be days like this one."
That was the beginning of a funny round robin to see who could describe their experience in the most colorful language. The ride home brought the joyful relief I had awaited all day. At times, our stories halted all laughter as we noticed someone's eyes filled with tears. There were tales of flying books and pencils, and words that pierced the soul. But there were also descriptions of polite students who volunteered to sit beside us or offered to lend back homework assignments or flashed a warm smile just when we needed it most. Our respite was over all too soon. As we approached Mrs. Bates' home, I saw news reporters. My headache started up again.